Thank you to our speakers. Those were just incredible, the knowledge and the presentation style. And I just wish that we could do this maybe once a week rather than once a year. Joe's laughing real sarcastically over there. When we first held our first international conference on climate change in New York City several years ago, one of the reasons we did so was those of us that had been reading the scientific literature, that had studied the data, that were in communication with the scientists, with the economists who've studied the issues surrounding climate change, surrounding global warming, surrounding whether or not humans are having an influence, if so, how much, what are the consequences, all these topics. We had the data, we had the information, we had the studies on the internet, but having the scientists themselves present it and having the public being aware of it, knowing where to find it, was an entirely different matter. And beyond that, having our elected leaders aware of it and having the courage to stand up and act on it was another step that at the time was in its infancy. We had certainly some elected leaders that knew where to find the literature, knew where to find the scientific data, and had displayed courage, but there were others who we were confident would follow that same path if they just had a little more access to the scientists in this room, to the studies, to the raw data. And we're very happy to see that over the past 5, 6, 7 years, public opinion has changed dramatically where people are aware of the science. Our elected leaders are no longer pushing for cap and trade laws, carbon taxes, et cetera. Waxman-Markey went down in flames, was not enacted into law. This was something that 5, 6, 7 years ago, many people could not have foreseen or even guessed would happen. We are very privileged this afternoon to have one of those courageous elected leaders here joining us for lunch and giving the first presentation. Jim Sensenbrenner has always been on the side of sound science. He's always made it a point to look into the facts, to stand up for sound science, and not to let the pressure of be it the media, be it environmental activist groups, take away our focus on sound science and on making sure that public policy reflects the science such as that presented here at this conference. The Honorable Jim Sensenbrenner represents the 5th Congressional District of Wisconsin. He has served the district since his election in November 1978 after serving 10 years in the Wisconsin State Legislature. He serves on the Committee on the Judiciary and the Committee on Science and Technology. He also serves as ranking member on the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, as well as a select committee on energy independence and global warming. He is the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee and former chairman of the House Committee on Science, where he solidified his reputation as an independent leader on science issues. Ladies and gentlemen, the Honorable Jim Sensenbrenner.
Well, thank you again, and thank you for that warm welcome. This is the second time that I've spoken before a Heartland Institute International Conference on Climate Change, and things are a lot better now than they were back even 3 years ago. So I'd like to thank you for this invitation to give you this update, and we've come an awful long way since 3 years ago. When I last spoke, the House of Representatives was poised to pass the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill. I call it cap and tax because that's what it is. The UN was promising the extension and expansion of the Kyoto Protocol, and President Obama was touting Spain as our model for a massive increase in renewable energy subsidies. 3 years later, cap and tax is dead. The Kyoto Protocol is set to expire, and Spain recently announced that it had eliminated new renewable energy subsidies. We won on all these issues because we were right. We highlighted the devastating economics of the proposed solutions and cried foul when proponents tried to bridge gaps in scientific understanding with fear instead of with knowledge. While the recovery has been anemic under the Obama administration, we'd be slipping toward a depression if Waxman-Markey had become law. The Heritage Foundation found that unemployment would have increased by nearly 2 million in 2012, and total GDP loss would have been 9.4 trillion by 2035. That's trillion with a T. And despite this huge cost, it would have had virtually no impact on climate change. If all 1,500 plus pork-legged pages of the Waxman-Markey's provisions were fulfilled, the predicted temperature decrease would have been 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. That's the bargain price of $47 trillion per degree per century. I will repeat that, $47 trillion per degree per century. In 1997, I led the congressional delegation to the now infamous negotiations in Kyoto. The story was the same then as it is now. The Kyoto Protocol and the negotiations that followed had been nothing more than an attempt to force a massive transfer of wealth from the developed to the developing world. Even if the emissions from the developed countries were reduced to zero, emissions in developing countries are increasing so rapidly that global emissions would still be higher by 2050 than they are today. Nonetheless, proponents of the Kyoto Protocol not only demanded that developed countries accept the one-sided obligation, but to pay hundreds of billions of dollars and offer free access to our intellectual property as well. Prior to the UN COP in Copenhagen, China and the developing world announced their price for participation, 1% of the developed world's gross domestic product. For the U.S., this would have meant spending $140 billion a year in developing countries including China, Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. Developing countries made clear that this was to be in addition to the $28 billion in foreign aid that we are distributing each year. The Indian government, in its filing to the United Nations, went further and added that the payment should be mandatory and, quote, not subject to decisions of developed country governments and legislatures. So much for democracy and the constitutions of any democratic country that gives the power of the purse and the power of taxation to the elected parliament. The electoral consequences for proponents of these policies was severe. It is unthinkable that in early 2009 that Republicans might retake the House in the 2010 election. I was on the House floor on June 29, 2009, when then Speaker Nancy Pelosi desperately pulled members aside to lobby, beg, and bargain for votes for the Waxman-Markey bill. Over two dozen of the members she convinced to vote yes lost their jobs just 16 months later. And this was largely the result of their support of Waxman-Markey. And if you looked at the polling both before and after the election in these districts, Waxman-Markey was the number one issue that brought about the defeat of a Democratic representative. And many of them had been in for a very long time. However, less well known is the fact, for all the discussion of hanging chads in Florida, it was his support of cap and tax that cost Al Gore the presidency in 2000. West Virginia's five electoral votes would have tipped the election for Gore, and Gore's near-evangelical support of climate change easily cost him the 42,000 votes he would have needed to win there and gone to the White House and rammed cap and tax in Kyoto through the Congress. As much progress as we have made, several issues remain. Developing countries continue to demand climate reparations, and the European Union continues to look for new ways to levy illegal taxes on non-EU citizens. Especially nefarious is the EU's claim that its tax on airline admissions is not a tax at all. The EU is already using this goofy logic that try to trace revenues beyond its own overtaxed residents. They say it's not a tax when they charge U.S. citizens to fly on U.S. airlines to and from Europe. They say it's not a tax when they charge U.S. companies to trade goods with Europe. The EU approach exposes how out of touch advocates of carbon regulations are forcing carbon cuts at any cost, as rising fuel costs, slow economic growth, and increased international competition create greater than ever challenges for the airline industry. The EU is proposing new regulations on carbon dioxide. Not only is this a blatant violation of international law, it's a disastrous economic policy. As we have pushed for a sensible response to climate change, we haven't always been thanked for our opposition. Following the vote on Waxman-Markey, Nobel laureate and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman accused my colleagues and me of treason against the planet. Mr. Krugman, I plead guilty as charged. When Dr. Gabriel Calzado of the King Juan Carlos University in Madrid argued that Spain's subsidies were more of a cautionary tale than a success story, critics were quick to attack not only his study, but Dr. Calzado personally. The Obama administration, through the National Renewable Energies Laboratories at the Department of Energy, actually commissioned a white paper to slam the study. This was the U.S. government funding a paper to criticize a Spanish professor's critique of Spanish government policy, proof that, like global warming itself, global warming attacks know no boundaries. Similarly, when scientists first criticized the IPCC claim that the Himalayan glaciers were highly likely to be gone by 2035, IPCC Chairman Dr. Pachauri initially dismissed their findings as, quote, voodoo science. I wonder if Dr. Pachauri was plucking feathers out of the chicken when he said that. Of course, the IPCC was later forced to concede that the critics were in fact right, and the claims regarding the Himalayan glaciers were not based on sound science. Because we have all become so accustomed to this kind of abuse, the emails leaked from the East Anglia University were no surprise. They simply revealed to the world what we already knew. There is a portion of the scientific community that is more interested in defending its findings rather than in finding the truth. As one scientist wrote, I tried hard to balance the need of the science and the IPCC, which were not always the same. ClimateGate revealed that climate science is less about honest debate than ideological warfare. Despite the relentless push to dismiss the emails and to clear the scientists involved, the leaked emails can only be honestly read as an exposure of partisanship among climate change scientists. For that reason, it tainted not only the science, but the investigations that would follow as groups scrambled to exonerate the scientists involved and to minimize the impact of their words. I support energy independence and both greater and more diverse energy production, but how you get there matters. Going forward, we must continue to oppose bad ideas and to continue to support technological development the only way it works, by allowing markets to determine the technological winners and losers. Similarly, how we conduct ourselves in this debate matters. I lament that climate science, like so much in our current political arena, has become partisan. Everything has become personal. It's part of the standard Washington hypocrisy to lament increased partisan before launching a partisan attack. But civility matters. Cap and tax is bad policy. Kyoto is bad policy. And I will continue to oppose policies that will needlessly increase regulation, slow economic growth, or attempt to choose technological winners and losers. We can continue to win these debates on the strength of our arguments without recourse to unsavory tactics that only serve to detract from our message. The message, to paraphrase what James Carville said in 1992 when he said, "It's the economy, stupid. It's the message, stupid." And the message is, it's bad economics, it's unsure science, and it will slow economic growth and slow our job creation. We used that message in 2010 to have a huge victory on this issue. We even used it way back in 2000 when the other side and Al Gore was riding high. We've got a good message. Let's stick to the message. Let's not get off message. And in 3 years, if I'm invited to come back here, I'll have an even better progress report than I've given you today. So thank you very much for your invitation.
And ladies and gentlemen, the congressman is available for questions, so we have our usual forces here. Tee it up.
Yeah, I would like to ask all of you who are asking questions to state your name and your affiliation.
James Rust, Atlanta, Georgia, retired engineering professor from Georgia Tech. NYOB is an answer to this question. Is the Romney group going to support positive energy policy?
Well, absolutely, because the Obama group has supported every negative energy policy that has come up. You know, he was for cap and tax until it helped lose him in the majority in the House. He is trying to obstruct the Keystone Pipeline, and I think that's a 70% to 80% issue. He's been opposed to offshore drilling until he's for doing a study on it. That's called buying time. When all else fails, try to buy time and hope people forget. Then I could go on and on and on and on. You know, what I will tell you is that if we have a Republican Senate and a Republican House of Representatives, there will be an energy independence bill that will be passed. It will be done in conjunction with a President Romney, and if there isn't a President Romney, we will dare President Obama to veto it. Yeah, next.
My name is Bill Lindquist. I'm an alien geologist living in Marin County, California.
I feel sorry for you.
Yes, as we all know, it's a hotbed of environmental liberalism. How come Markey and Waxman are still around?
Because they have safe districts. Just like Nancy Pelosi has a safe district on the other side of the bridge. Who's next?
Yes, hello, my name's Tom Harris with the International Climate Science Coalition. In 2009, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, who funds a great deal of the climate campaigners, chastised the people in that side of the debate, saying that they shouldn't approach the climate issue directly. They should stop pushing cap and trade and should try to make low-carbon energy sources seem cheap. So that sounds to me like climate policy by stealth. Is that what is happening in Washington?
Well, I can say they've tried. I think the failure of climate policy by stealth is a firm called Solyndra. And you can dig deep into your pocket, because we taxpayers are going to end up paying over $500 million in defaulted loan guarantees. Now, to make things even worse, the Department of Energy, and I blame the boss, Secretary Chu, on this, revised the loan guarantee provisions of the government money so that the investors came first and the government came second. And that's exactly opposite to the way it is with practically every other loan guarantee, whether it is in the energy field or whether it's student loans or small business loans you know, or anything else. So, you know, the investors ended up having no money at risk, and we taxpayers ended up holding up the bag. Now, I have introduced legislation to have an outside audit done on not only Solyndra, but the other recipients of this government largesse, much of which was in the stimulus bill, so we can find out exactly what the deal was on how they got money and make sure that that doesn't happen again, because the Solyndra loss is the tip of the iceberg, I fear, and I'm afraid that we're going to see a lot more money that was shelled out to various entities that would be producing products that would never make it in the marketplace.
Congressman, hi. My name is Bob Bauman. I am a small business manufacturer in the People's Republic of Maryland. But I was born and raised in Wisconsin, so there is some hope yet.
We'd like you to come back to help pay some of our taxes. You know, ours are going down with our governor, and yours are going up with yours.
I've already met with him, and I totally concur.
Go ahead.
One state at a time, right? My question is, what is Congress's strategy within the Republicans for dealing with the overreach of the EPA?
Well, it's difficult when you have an administration that's on the other side. Both the Science Committee that I serve as vice chairman of and the Energy and Commerce Committee have sent some rather direct oversight letters to Administrator Lisa Jackson. When she replies, and that's not always the case, she's usually danced around what the actual question is, and she will never directly appear before either of the committees, but she ends up sending underlings, which is kind of a way that you can hit the target close to the target but not hit the target herself. The powers that Congress has on administrative regulations were sharply curtailed about 30 years ago. And a Supreme Court case called the Immigration and Naturalization Service versus Chadha. And the Chadha case held that the Congress did not have the authority to review, kill, or modify or delay administrative regulations because this was a violation of the doctrine of separation of powers. In other words, the court said that this is none of Congress's business to stick their nose in administrative regulations, even though administrative regulations have the same force of law as bills that were passed by Congress and signed by the president in the process that all of us learned in high school civics. The only tool that we have left is something called the Congressional Review Act. And under the Congressional Review Act, both houses of Congress can pass a bill under an expedited procedure, which means no filibusters, but it goes to the president for his signature. And this is a guaranteed veto regardless of the subject and regardless of who is in the White House, because any president will back up his bureaucrats and sign the bill. And the only time Congress has been successful under the Congressional Review Act was during the change of administration between the Clinton and Bush 43 administrations, where it was a Clinton regulation that was killed and Bush signed the bill simply because there was a change in the hand that was on the veto pen. So I guess we can squawk, we can bring the public's attention to the overreach that the EPA is doing on all sorts of issues, and it's not just on the climate change issue. But in terms of actually effectuating getting rid of some of these or making them workable or preventing them from costing Americans jobs and preventing jobs from being exported overseas, we need a new person in the White House who will appoint more practical people that serve in these administrative agency positions. And the way to get rid of Lisa Jackson is to get rid of Barack Obama. Excuse my partisan slip. Yeah.
I'm Jay Lair, Science Director of the Heartland Institute. interesting just to comment on what you just said about I'm not allowed to speak politically, and I'm out working for on behalf of Heartland every week somewhere in the United States talking to groups, and we can't do anything politically, so I never talk about the president, but I focus on the fact that we must get rid of the different people that are the secretaries of the various agencies, and Lisa Jackson is the worst, and I think that's non-political just to expose her.
Well, I agree with you
what
on
she's
that.
Doing in her son.
You know, I hear from Democrats complaining yeah. about her too. So it's,
and she is the worst. My question is, my understanding is that Mr. Romney is a supporter of man-caused global warming and of renewable energy, and I'm scared to death that that is true.
Well, I don't think it is, because I've asked him that question, and when before the Wisconsin primary, you know, he was asked those questions, and you know, he's not for cap and tax, he's not for Kyoto. You know, I think there are some of us in Congress that can continue to drive the fact that a cap and tax boils down to a massive transfer of wealth from the United States to countries who are major competitors of ours, like China and India now, and that if it's the economy, we ought to protect the economy by not passing job-destroying and exporting legislation like cap and tax. I can assure you that no cap and tax legislation will be passed by Congress. Waxman and Markey did not even reintroduce their bill, nor was there a Senate counterpart that was introduced. And the son of Kyoto Treaty has about as much chance as passing the Senate as the original Kyoto Treaty didn't pass the Senate. And I think it's very significant that even though President Clinton signed the Kyoto Treaty, he never sent it to the Senate for ratification because he knew it would have been shot down overwhelmingly. Presidents do not like to see treaties defeated in the Senate.
What about renewable energy?
Well, about renewable energy, you know, I think there's a huge lesson in the Solyndra fiasco, and I think you're going to start seeing various types of tax breaks and subsidies like the ones we have for wind energy and solar energy disappearing because we have to get a handle on our debt, we have to get a handle on our deficit, and if we don't get a handle on those types of things, the economic discussions that we are having here and at previous conferences are largely going to be moot. Now, there is good news. The ethanol subsidy expired at the end of the year, much to all of our surprise. The next thing that ought to go is the mandate.
It's Pat Michaels from the Cato Institute. I have a question for you. I think one of the subsidies that is perhaps rankles the voters more than anything else is the $7,500 that a person gets off his taxes for buying a Chevrolet Volt. I would argue that this will be a litmus test for President Romney. Will he stop the subsidy for the Volt?
Well, Congress will stop the subsidy on that. And if you look at the people who buy Chevrolet Volts and some of these, it's the 1%, the people that can afford to spend, you know, a lot of money on cars. You know, I drive around a lot of times in my late father-in-law's 1994 Cadillac. It was not defined as a clunker, by the way, but in the Cash for Clunkers program, I would say it makes about 15 miles to the gallon, so it's not very fuel efficient, but it really isn't the gas guzzler. My colleague Paul Ryan calls it the whale, and I like it. And I'm not going to trade that in for a Chevy Volt, whether I get $7,500 off my taxes or not.
Hi, Congressman Sensenbrenner. This question comes from Paul, who currently lives in Sweden, and he's a retired network management program manager. His question is, what can be done to rein in the EPA? Can certain EPA functions be defunded?
The answer to that question is very clearly yes. We have not voted on the EPA energy and water bill yet in Congress. And I would imagine that's going to take quite a long time because dealing with under the congressional rules, you can't change the legislation. You can't reduce the appropriation. It's either giving them what they want or giving them nothing. And I think at least in the House of Representatives, you're going to see a vast majority on a bipartisan basis for giving them nothing. So Congress does hold the power of the purse, and it's about time we shut the purse strings off for people who are way out in left field in terms of job creation and a vibrant economy.
Congressman, I'm a state senator from Wyoming, and last year Congress took an unprecedented step of actually voting to remove the wolf from the endangered species list, first time that's any species that's been removed. Was that a one-offer, or could that be the pattern for future congressional action in case the current president gets reelected?
Well, first of all, it depends upon exactly where we are economically. I think the reason that the wolf got delisted, and I supported that. We've got wolves in my backyard in southern Wisconsin, as a matter of fact, is that the wolves were running around eating cattle and dogs and, whatever they could corner and get their teeth into. And that was an economic hurt, more so in your part of the country than in mine. But when packs of wolves run around, it's bad news. So, yeah, they are delisted. But there were reasons other than an EPA overreach that got the wolf delisted from the endangered species list. And it was also put in a bill that the president had to sign. So he wasn't able to veto the bill and claim that these nice furry little creatures that go around eating everything that they can find, is something that ought to be protected.
My name is Willis Eschenbach, and I'm just a guy. My question is, the authority of the EPA to regulate CO2 seems to rest on a misunderstanding of congressional intent in the Clean Air Act. Is there any movement to amend the Clean Air Act to make it clear that it was not intended for CO2?
There have been moves, but it's been resisted by the White House in the other side. All of this stems from a decision about 4 years ago in EPA versus Massachusetts, where CO2 was labeled a pollutant and thus subject to regulation by the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, there are no more scientists than most of us who serve in the Congress, are scientists. And I think that this was an erroneous decision. CO2 is a natural gas. Now, does this mean that all of us have got to put catalytic converters on our noses so that there's no CO2 that escapes into the atmosphere every time we exhale? And nothing would be green around the world without CO2. So, the fact that people think that CO2 is a pollutant like SO2 or NOx, which is a pollutant, I think basically goes from propaganda that really does not look into the chemical qualities that make up CO2, and the fact that CO2 does a lot of good for our society, like help farmers grow crops that we eat. So, I guess I can, kind of shrug my shoulders on that. And if there's more CO2 in the atmosphere and crop yields go up and maybe the growing season becomes a little longer, it'll be easier for the world to feed 7 billion people going to 9 than it would be if we have famines and a shortage of food. So, I'm not here, running around saying CO2 is bad for you. You can inhale and exhale as much as you want. That's different than carbon monoxide. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Thank you.